sit where I can see everybody. Sometime back, a few months back, there was a request that, at least from time to time when I come to visit, we try to cover a certain topic or a theme or chapter from the Gita or some chapter from Srimad Bhagavatam. There's feedback in this. Could you fix that? So this is one of those weekends. And the topic that I'd like to discuss this weekend and also into Saturday next weekend is the 13th chapter. 13th is a good number, right? 13th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1. And the title of the chapter, the subject of the chapter is Dhritarashtra Quits Home. So there's some very nice understandings. I picked the chapter because it's very rich in elaborating on some of the basic themes of the whole first canto of Bhagavatam. It's diverse. The cast of actors in the drama keeps changing, so it's very lively. It's very much at the heart of the whole of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam also. Particularly, the whole of Srimad Bhagavatam is the question of Maharaj Parikshit that he raised when he was cursed to die in 7 days. What is the duty of one who knows they're about to die? So, as we all know, we could all raise our hands and ask the question, how many here are certain that we're going to die? Everybody's certain that we're going to die. And do we know if it's today or tomorrow or next week? We don't know. But for certain, that event will come. And one way of looking at the purpose of human life, when I was visiting recently at Cornell University, this is the topic, part of the topic that we spoke about. What's the purpose of life? You get a good job, make a lot of money, raise children, and die, right? That's the purpose of life. It's more than the purpose of life goes beyond that. The purpose of life is the human form of life. Purpose is to become self-realized, to understand our relationship, our eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and to return to that position. That's what the human mission is, the human life's mission. And so that's the purpose, and then how to achieve it. Very clearly, in the whole of the Bhagavatam, how to achieve it is by receiving that gift from one who has the gift to give it. That's Shukadeva Goswami gives that gift to Maharaj Parikshit. Not only the understanding and the means, but the spiritual empowerment to achieve it. So that's what there's three different episodes in this chapter where it comes up in quick succession. So that's where we're going to begin this afternoon. We'll cover the first 7 verses of chapter 13, Dhritarashtra Quits Home. And it begins, the chapter opens with Shukadeva Goswami speaking, and he's explaining excuse me, Sutta Goswami is speaking, what he heard from Shukadeva Goswami, and he's explaining about, the first two verses are about Vidura's life, the latter half of Vidura's life. So, Vidura, during his lifetime, he was a very wonderful personality, a bit enigmatic personality, at least within the royal family, because on the one hand, he was always very wise, always very respected, and as someone who is wise is always very respected. And yet, he had this position of being the son of a Shudrani. The Vedic system is that according to the, if there is a Anulom situation where the father is of a higher caste, the mother is of a lower caste, so that's a proper arrangement, the other is something else. But when that, in that kind of an arrangement, the consideration of, or the designation of that individual who is born from that combination is he accepts the caste of the mother. There's an example of this. We, during Janmashtami, when visiting here, this was, we spoke about this. One king, Devamira, from the Yadu dynasty, he settled in the area of Mathura. And so he was a member of the royal family, and he had two wives. One was also of the same Kshatriya stock, and the other was of Vaishya stock. And it's very, very exalted in the Vaishya community, without going into the detail, there's detail to tell, but... So, Shura, one son born of the royal mother was Shura, or Shurasena. So, he was the king, and following Devamira. And the other son from the wife who was from the Vaishya family was Nanda. We actually, there were five sons, and Nanda Maharaj was the third amongst those five sons. But so he was the, Parjanya was the other son. And, then he had five sons, one of which was Nanda Maharaj. So, because Nanda Maharaj was born of the Yadu dynasty, Nanda Maharaj was also born in the Yadu dynasty, but his mother was a Vaishya family, so he took the status of being a Vaishya, and so he took the occupation of herding the calves and the cows in Vrindavan, which he liked to do very much. But he was still a very exalted nature, so he was accepted amongst all as the king of the cowherdsmen. His father, Pajanya Maharaj, and also his himself, Nanda Maharaj. So like that, Vidura was his father. Who was Vidura's father? Vyasadev. So his father was not only, we could say he was, his father was a Brahmin, but his father was incarnation of the Lord, pretty exalted father. And his mother, who was his mother? The maidservant of Ambika. So one of the, Ambika was the mother of Pandu, and the maidservant of Ambika was the mother of Vidura. So he also then accepted that designation. The Sanskrit word is upadi. So he was Shudrani, the son of a Shudra. And yet, his father was Vyasadeva. So he was very, very exalted. And not only his parentage was exalted, but he himself was exalted. Vidura is actually none other than
Yamaraj,
who is very exalted. The personality who is so qualified that, just like in our worldly society, the Supreme Court judge, however many there's 11 of them or something in the United States, 11 Supreme Court judges. So for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, or whatever is comparable in India. But this is not just Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States or of India. This is Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the universe, who is so empowered that he perfectly knows the deeds of every living being, every human being, in the universe. Perfectly. He must have a very high gigabyte computer. And lots of data entryers to keep track of all of that. Either that, or he has a super brain, or super empowered. Just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said to Digvijay, when Digvijay was one very, very learned pandit who came to visit in Navadvip, and Digvijay was very proud. Sometimes scholars are humble, but usually they're not so humble. If they're very, very, very scholarly, they want to make sure that people know how scholarly they are. And Digvijay was that kind of person. So he traveled all over India challenging people to scholarly debates. That was his thing. And so when he arrived in Navadvip Dham, he heard that the most learned of everybody in this whole the MIT campus or something, was this little boy, Nimai Pandit. So he went and challenged Nimai Pandit to engage in some discussion with him. And Nimai, understanding the pride of this man, just flattered him. This is one way to disarm a proud person. You just honor them. You are so learned. Can you do this? Can you compose verses in glorification of Mother Ganga? Oh, of course I can compose verses in praise of Mother Ganga. No problem. So within non-stop, like the wind, he composed verses in Sanskrit spontaneously with perfect rhyme and meter and alliteration and all kinds of literary embellishments. 100 verses non-stop. Took him about an hour. As fast as the wind. And when he was finished, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, in the 37th of those 100 verses, could you tell me what were the literary ornaments and the faults in that verse? And Digvijay said, there were no faults in that verse. It was perfect. Don't you know, I'm Digvijay. I don't make any mistakes. It was all perfect. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu once again said, I'm just a boy. But perhaps you can... I'll describe for you the ornaments, if you like. Then he recited the verse back, 37 out of 100. And Digvijay said, how did you remember that? Perfectly. And Lord Chaitanya said, some people, they're empowered by the Supreme Lord to compose Sanskrit poetry spontaneously. And some people, they're empowered to have perfect memories. Then all the power is coming from the same source, the Supreme Lord. You shouldn't be surprised. One person is empowered this way, another person is empowered that way. So, Dharmaraj, or Yamaraj, he's empowered. He's empowered with this capacity to have somebody come before him and know perfectly, exactly, in detail, what are his qualities, what are his faults. Like X-ray vision. And there are many people that have been in Prabhupada's association. I would say, for me, one of the most astounding repeated themes of people that met Srila Prabhupada will say, the first time I met Srila Prabhupada, two things they'll say, that whatever it was that concerned me, the anxieties, worldly things, it just went away. just like darkness is dissipated by the rising of the sun. It's just gone. That was one thing. And then another thing that they repeatedly say is, I felt that Prabhupada looked right through me. I was in his, he looked at me and I thought he knew exactly where I'm at, exactly my thoughts, exactly my heart, all my contaminations, and I felt like just evaporating because I felt so unworthy to be in his presence. So when this very, very spiritually powerful personality is present, they have such quality. Yamaraj has such quality. Effortlessly. He didn't have to pull on his chin and scratch his head and try to, you know, empirically figure it out. It just was disclosed to him. So that was one feature of Yamaraj. And another is that Yamaraj is the perfect upholder of religiosity himself. The perfect judge is the perfect performer of proper activity. Or should we say it the other way around? The perfect performer of proper activity is eligible to evaluate the activity of others. And yet, we find in the life of Yamaraj that he apparently did a very bad thing. A perfect upholder of Dharma, Dharmaraj himself, did a very bad thing. And the bad thing goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a great rishi whose name was Manduka Muni. Manduka Muni was very, very exalted personality. We'll see about his exalted qualities in just a moment. Very exalted. And he was living in the forest alone, engaging in austerities. And one day, some thieves in the village near where he was living in the forest performed some robbery. And they took their booty and ran into the forest. And the people found out about the robbery and the constables began chasing them. So they knew that they were being chased by the constables, and so they went and hid inside the hermitage of Manduka Muni. And of course they looked like ruffians, and Manduka Muni looked like a sage. He didn't look like a polished, you know, city boy. He was doing austerities in the forest. And when the constables came, they thought he's one of them. And they apprehended them. They brought them before a judge who wasn't as qualified as Yamaraj. And they were all sentenced to death with a sword, cut off their head. So just as they were about to be killed, all four of them, the three robbers and Manduka Muni, the word went to the king that one of these people isn't a robber at all. He's a great sage. Please stop this. So the king personally came and ordered it to be stopped, came before Manduka Muni, offered his prostrated obeisances. With folded hands, he pleaded with him, please forgive me for this unintentional mistake. Now this shows the quality of Manduka Muni. He didn't at all hold the king responsible. He didn't say, I'm going to smash you with my brahminical power. But he was very, very calm. He said that for you there's no fault. It's something like, we should learn a lesson from this. If Prabhupada taught us like this, if a stick is beating one, one doesn't blame the stick. But the person who's wielding the stick, that's another thing. So he saw that this king, he's just the instrument of Yamaraj. So he had such powers that he went to Yamaraj and he didn't start heavying Yamaraj out, as we say. He just asked Yamaraj, could you please explain why this punishment was being allowed, that I should be killed at sword point? And Yamaraj said, well, when you were a little boy, you had some straws and you were torturing insects. You were piercing insects with this straw. And for that act, for killing insects, piercing them with a straw, this was to be your death. But the king very graciously forgave you. And Mandukamuni said, so watch out. Don't play around with, this is for that young boy here. Don't play with insects. Don't mess with insects. Because you might end up like Mandukamuni. So, Mandukamuni said to Yamaraj, this is very, very poor judgment. Because a child is innocent. They may do some wrong thing, but they're not karmically held responsible for that wrong thing. When adulthood comes, that's something else. One should be able to distinguish between right and wrong. But a child may do some wrong, they're not to be punished in the same way. So for your lack of discretion, I curse you. But you should, this is the sign of ignorance, you don't know what is right and what is wrong, you should become a sudra. And to show the quality of Yamaraj, he didn't protest. He accepted, you're right, I've offended you, please forgive me, I accept this curse. So he then became Vidura, the son of a very, very exalted father, Vyasadeva, and born to the royal family of the Pandavas, those that ruled the earth planet, Vidura. So needless to say, his qualities in many ways were very, very exalted. He knew just what was the right thing to be done and the things to be avoided in life. Wouldn't it be nice if we had such power? If we knew the right things to do and knew the wrong things, what to avoid in all circumstances of life? What a blessing that would be. But that was Vidura. And he was there also to guide the royal family. So naturally, Yudhisthira Maharaj, who was the son of Kunti and also the son, his father was the same, Yamaraj, that Yudhisthira was an emblem of virtue and Vidura regularly guided him. Perfect arrangement with the Supreme Lord. For the son of Yamaraj to be guided by Yamaraj, only in different lila. Perfect arrangement. And he was also giving guidance to his very dear elder brother, Dhritarashtra. And just a little bit, because it's important in this whole scenario, the relationship between Vidura and Dhritarashtra was one of brotherly affection, was one of deep regard and respect. At the same time, there was always this tension. Sometimes that exists between brothers, but rarely is it like this, where one is the emblem of virtue and the other one is the emblem of blindness. I mean, emblem of blindness. Literally blind, physically blind, and spiritually blind. So Vidura was always giving very loving brotherly counsel to his elder brother, and his elder brother was very kindly maintaining him in royal opulence. Although he was by caste a Shudra, he was by quality far more than Shudra, and he was given royal property, part of the royal palace and, you know, the royal scene. He was entrusted with some residence and some land and some responsibilities like that, although he wasn't technically a member of the royal family. And, of course, the most known part of the whole drama of Vidura's life was as the Kurukshetra battle was becoming more and more obvious and imminent, Vidura was getting stronger and stronger with his brother. And Dhritarashtra and Duryodhan didn't like that at all, and so he indirectly insulted him by referring to his lineage. Now later on, Vidura just brushes it aside. But at this particular point, he took it in the right way. As one who is wise, it's advised like this. Those of you that are trying to become wise, or know others that are wise. This is a very important, the quality that Vidura exhibited was very important. That is the quality of detachment. That is, if, like Chanakya Pandit, when he gave some advice to the king, and the king was not so sure because the king was a little attached. I don't know if I want to follow his advice. Chanakya Pandit said, okay, no problem, I'll just go reside somewhere else. No, don't. Please stay, I'll do what you say. I'm too much dependent upon your good counsel. So Prabhupada has given that example. It's incumbent upon a person who has wisdom to also have this very, very great quality of detachment. And that way one can be attached to the truth and not attached to the political situation or one's material situation or conveniences of life. A truly knowledgeable person should be. So Vidura was in that position, and when he was insulted by Duryodhana, he left. They didn't leave like storming out the door and, as we say these days, fried. It wasn't like that. He took it as a benediction of the Supreme Lord, like Narada did when his mother was bitten by the snake when she went to get water at the well, and she died instantly because of the poisonous snake bite. He is just a young boy, Narada, in his previous life. So he just accepted, somehow this is the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, I accept it. Joyfully, I accept the arrangement of the Supreme Lord in my life. And now let me take proper advantage of that which the Lord is providing for me. So Vidura did the same. He went on pilgrimage. Let me take this as an opportunity to just get out of this royal intrigue here and just purify my existence. Let me act in a positive way that will elevate my consciousness given this circumstance. So he did. He went on pilgrimage for a very, very long time. And mind you, this insult happened prior to the Kurukshetra battle. You can go through it chronologically and add up the amount of time. Before the Kurukshetra battle, the installation of Maharaj Yudhisthira on the throne, and he's living as the king for some time. I did a calculation once. It's somewhere between 30 and 35 years he was on pilgrimage. That's a long pilgrimage. At least for us in America, to go on pilgrimage. Well, some of you also, you get an opportunity to go back to India. So your first obligation, you must visit your family and relatives and so on. Then you may get some number of days that you can go on pilgrimage. You go 1 or 2 days to Vrindavan, and Haridwar and Rishikesh a little bit, and maybe some of these and those in a few places, and that's it. You have to come back and go to work. Take care of your responsibilities. Well, Vidura didn't just go on pilgrimage for a week or a month, half a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. 30 years. 30, 35 years pilgrimage. And what happens when you go to holy places? The idea is to become purified, to become attached to the Supreme, and simultaneously to become detached from worldly things. So that's what happened. Already, here's the sequence. Vidura is, I'm still in the first verse of the chapter, but Vidura is already very, very exalted personality. Very wise and very detached. But still he wants to make his life perfect. So he deliberately takes up some activity that will further purify, further attach him to the Supreme, further detach him from worldly conceptions and all those things. But that, all of that is preparatory. The most important thing happens later on. Later on he meets Maitreya. And this is a very, very important part of the chapter, the description of Vidura's meeting Maitreya. All this other stuff is just background to help build up this to this momentous event where he meets Maitreya Muni in the third, fourth and on into the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, it's all those discussions between Vidura and Maitreya. It's a big part of Srimad Bhagavatam. So here we're only hearing like two verses. There was a lot of time he spent with Maitreya Muni. And what was Maitreya Muni's qualification? Just many things, but the most important thing is he had directly heard from Uddhava. Actually, he directly heard from Krishna when Krishna was speaking Uddhava Gita. Maitreya was there. He heard the whole thing. And it wasn't like Dhritarashtra hearing from Sanjaya about Krishna narrating Bhagavad Gita. He realized the whole thing. He directly heard from Krishna, and he told everything that he had realized and understood directly to Vidura. That's specific succession. Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo viduhu. You know this verse, right? So, it hadn't sakali neha mahata yoga nashta. It hadn't been nashta yet, because time hadn't passed. It was very fresh. Imagine how illuminated in realization Maitreya Muni was. And he was also living in a detached manner and fully enlightened state, and Vidura, passing through the sacred places, just happened upon. It wasn't just happened upon, it was the Lord's arrangement. He was ready. And so he met Maitreya Muni. And the introductory verse says that he questioned Maitreya to his heart's content, to his full satisfaction, so that all of his questions were answered. Could you imagine having all of your questions answered? To the point of realization. And you have a perfect, realized person to ask. So that's what Vidura had. And he was already exalted, purified, perfect in Dharma, perfectly detached, attached to the Supreme, and then he meets Maitreya. That's how the chapter begins. There's Vidura, the character is introduced for the first time in this first canto, Bhagavatam. So he's fully realized soul. That's the first verse. Then it says that he became, through that effort, he became completely established in transcendental loving service to Lord Krishna. This is also very significant. From the message of whole Srimad Bhagavatam, what is the fruit, if we were to say, the benefit to be derived from any beneficial activity? Think of any beneficial: being charitable, being honest, being truthful, performing religious ceremonies, undergoing prescribed austerities, whatever are the things. What is to be gained from all that? Ultimately, what is to be gained from all that? What is to be gained from all that is to be fixed in transcendental loving service to the Supreme Lord. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita, essentially. Vedaish chasayarvayar aham eva vedyo Vedanta Krit Veda Vid Eva Chaham. The goal of all the Vedas is to know Krishna. And Krishna is only known by devotional service. Bhaktyamam abhijanati yavanyas chasmi tatvataha. Tatvata, to know Krishna in truth perfectly, is only possible through what Vidura attained, being established in transcendental loving service to the Supreme Lord. The function of Maitreya in relation to Vidura was not just to teach him new things that he didn't know. That's the duty of a spiritual master, is not just to introduce new subject matters that are very interesting. And with much more detail, learn about the technology of how things happen. How does the universe create it? And you get all that technology down. It's not a science of technology. It's a science of perfecting the quality of life, or to make one's relationship, put it this way, the duty of spiritual master is to reconnect the disciple to their loving relationship with Krishna to the degree where that loving relationship is tangibly experienced and also palpably relished. Of course, it takes a very qualified disciple to come to that stage, and takes a very qualified spiritual master to accomplish that end. But that's the relationship, that's the responsibility of both parties. And that it was achieved. Vidura attained that. And when somebody attains that, I always used to ask this question, then what do you do? What is the conduct of somebody? What's it like to be in that position? What does somebody do who achieves that state? So, here's what Vidura did. Now we're on to the third verse. The very natural thing is, it's two natural things. One is to continue to relish that relationship in the form of loving service, and the other is acts of transcendental compassion in relation to other living beings who are also Krishna's parts and parcels. Compassion is a natural feature, certainly for a perfected soul. So now Vidura is going to exhibit, according to his discrimination, how to best display that compassion, that which he had received from Maitreya, which he had received from Krishna. He wanted to give to two groups of people, his nephews and his brother. And he gave one of the characteristics of someone who is not only very wise, but in Vidura's case now perfectly realized, is they know how to administer. In other words, he interacted with Yudhisthira and the Pandavas one way, and he interacted with Dhritarashtra another way, but the purpose was the same. We'll discuss that in the next few minutes. So he decides he's going to go back to the royal palace. He wants to give this gift that he got from Maitreya to his nephews and to his brother. So the scene unfolds. Actually, the next two verses are combined in our translation, 3 and 4. It describes who received him when he returned. So I'll just... Satyaki, Sanjaya was there. Kripacharya, Kunti, Gandhari, Draupadi, Subhadra, Uttara, Kripi, and many other wives of the Kauravas. Of course, the wives of the Kauravas, because the Kauravas, they're gone, so the wives were still there. They were taken care of in the royal palace by the royal family very nicely. And other ladies with children all hurried to meet him with great delight. It so appeared that they had regained their consciousness after a long period. So, 2 points. One is, very, very exalted. Take any one of these people and you can write a book about them. Draupadi. What exalted personality. Queen Kunti. Exalted personality. Any one of them. Sanjaya. What a mysterious yet wonderful personality, Sanjaya. And one by, and all of them together, they came rushing out of the royal palace to meet Uncle Vidura, who they hadn't seen in some 30, 35 years. I mean, they didn't know if he was alive or gone. And here he comes, radiant like the sun, like a realized sadhu. Because he had, when he left the royal palace, his wife didn't accompany him. He just went. So he was like in the renounced order. Not only like him, he was in the renounced order, and he was fully enlightened. So how joyful they were to see him again. How exalted were the personalities, and how joyful they were to see him again. And the second thing is, it's mentioned here and it's mentioned in the next verse also, that it was as if they were unconscious and had been brought back to consciousness. So this is another feature. So that is the feature of the presence of a sadhu in one's life. Just as Vidura, by the association of Maitreya, had become perfectly sadhu-like. And this is the process of how one becomes elevated is not just that one is virtuous or religious or righteous, but one combines that right kind of living, virtuous living, with the association of the sadhu. It's likened to taking a burning ember or a lit match and sticking it on a pile of dry leaves. Immediately the dry leaves ignite. So dry leaves is likened, as far as the modes of nature are concerned, it's likened to the quality of goodness. Just like if you have a piece of wood or dry leaves, something that's wet, wet leaves, there, put a match on wet leaves, nothing happens. Match goes out, that's what happens. But if you take those dry leaves and let them sit for some time and they become dry, the wet leaves become dry, then bring fire or a spark or to them and immediately another fire is ignited. So the quality of goodness in this world sometimes passes for, people use this terminology these days, they're a spiritual person. Meaning that they live by religious principle. They're situated in the quality of goodness. They're pious. Piety means one who follows what ought to be done and one refrains from what ought not to be done. Pious. Somebody asked me the other day, what does that mean, pious? That's what it means. You live by the quality of goodness. There's dharma, which means this is what is given by God, what you should do, and you do it. Quality of goodness. Just like when our car broke down last night. And Murari and Prem went to make a phone call and get AAA to come tow us. So some guy came along on the highway. I was thinking, this is like the biblical Good Samaritan. He stopped. He got out of the car and said, is there anything that I can do to help you? The other cars are going by, zoom, zoom, zoom. One guy stopped. Anything I can do to help you? And I just thought, good Samaritan. So he got out of the car and said, you know, can I get a tow truck for you? He said, I have a AAA card. He said, well, I've got a cell phone. I couldn't hear a thing. I had to, all the cars going by so fast. I had to sit inside. Anyway, he waited and made sure he got under the hood. Said, I'm a bit of a mechanic. I'm not sure what the problem is here. Maybe it's real simple. Anyway, he could have just gone by like everybody else, but he did that good act. So, and persons who do such things, that's living in the quality of goodness. It's piety. But beyond piety, even pious people, put it this way, yeah, even pious people require the association of a sadhu in order to elevate one's life. This is the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. Vidura required it, and Yudhisthira required it. Yudhisthira had the association again and again of Narada. And here he's getting the association of Vidura. And in fact, pious people, religious people, they want the association of such highly elevated personalities because it connects them further with the transcendental objective of life. So, although the members of the royal family are exalted in their virtue and piety, living by religious principle, they are compared to being without life, or at least unconscious, and their life regained, or their consciousness regained, just like when you're sleeping. The person's alive, but this is the language of the Bhagavatam. Persons who are devoid, in the second canto, this specific example is given. Persons who are devoid of atma-tattva. Atma-tattva means knowledge of the self. They're like in the agricultural field, a stick figure where there's cloth draped on the stick figure and the cloth is blowing in the wind. You've all seen this, right? Here in America, it's scarecrows, and in India, it's much simpler. It's just stick with a vertical and horizontal thing. They put a shirt over it, and in the wind, the thing blows. And it looks like, oh, there's an agriculturalist out in the field. So maybe the birds will stay away from the agriculture field. But there's no more life there, according to the Bhagavatam. There's no more life in human existence that's devoid of Atma Tattva than the life that's there in the scarecrow. Or this piece of cloth flapping in the wind. The movements of the material energy are making those who are devoid of self-knowledge, self-realization, do things, say things, raise families, and die. But their life has no more life than that. And when there's the opportunity for sadhu, sangha, it brings life into that body, or into the unconscious condition, to a level of consciousness. This is the language of the Bhagavatam. We're more than halfway done. So Vidura returns, they receive him very nicely, and with great delight. In fact, they cry in ecstasy, in happiness to see him. With great delight, they rush to him, and it appears that life is restoring in their bodies. It's because the sadhu is bringing Krishna. This verse will come later in the same chapter. I'll mention it now because it's worth mentioning again. It's one of the most important verses in this chapter is where Yudhisthira, when he begins speaking to Vidura, he says, saints of your caliber, Vidura, are likened unto places of pilgrimage unto yourself, like you go to a place of pilgrimage to get purified. But if you can find a saintly person, that's like going to a place of pilgrimage. Because those saints, he says, saints of your caliber, Vidura, you purify places of pilgrimage. When you go to a place of pilgrimage, it's not so that you can get purified. You go to purify the place of pilgrimage. And the explanation is given that when persons who are worldly and sinful and so forth, they go to the place of pilgrimage, they deposit their sinful reactions and leave. And then the accumulation of sinful reactions builds up. So saintly persons have to go there and burn up, incinerate those accumulated sinful reactions. Saintly persons are of such importance in Vedic culture, that's the point. And because they're very exalted in their character, they members of the royal family, they know that. And wonderfully, Vidura has attained that state. I'll just mention one thing that parallels all of this. When Krishna left Vrindavan, in one sense, in a higher sense, Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. When he so-called left Vrindavan, he entered into the hearts of the residents of Vrindavan and hid himself there, so it looked like he had gone. But actually he was within their hearts. He never left. But apparently he left. And in feeling his absence, the residents of Vrindavan were feeling great separation. And that great separation went on and on and on and on and on and on. Some of you who were here for the program last night, the Bhakti Vriksha gathering, the Bhagavad Gita study group, you maybe met Damayanti and John and their two boys, Hansa and Dhruva. So yesterday morning, Hansa asked me a question after our Bhagavatam class. He wanted to know, why was it that Krishna promised to the members of, to the gopis, that he would return? And then he never returned, Hansa asked. How come Krishna did that? But Krishna wants to, I gave an elaborate answer, but the short answer is, Krishna knows the heart of his devotee, and he simply wants to bring them pleasure. The hearts of the gopis is, they have unalloyed love, and love is intensified in that mode of separation. So he was heightening their love by indicating he would return, and yet leaving them in that position where they're anticipating his return, but it doesn't happen. It intensifies the love. The purpose was to intensify the love of the inhabitants, because actually he was with them. And they, in a higher sense, they knew that because they're perfected souls. But they were feeling this other feeling. So when Uddhava was sent with the message, I will return shortly, Krishna hand wrote a letter to the gopis, I will return very soon. There's only 3-4 more demons left to kill. I'll take care of them, and surely very soon I'll come and join you. So when Uddhava came, there's many things, but when Uddhava came, one of the things he noted was everybody was just totally mad and feelings of separation. In that condition of madness, they were not taking care of themselves at all. Just like when you see a mad person, they neglect their external, you know, sense of well-being. It just gets totally neglected. So Radharani was in that condition too. She wasn't combing her hair and wasn't dressing herself properly and looked like completely disheveled. This had gone on for years of that kind of neglect. And when Uddhava saw her in that condition, he was smashed. And when she did her talks with the bumblebee and the whole thing, he could understand. Her love for Krishna is extraordinary. So he just broke out and said, Radharani, I will bring Krishna here. Please stop this horrible feeling that you're feeling. She didn't pay any attention to him at all. I don't believe you. You're this horrible messenger. I don't trust you for a minute. And your master is worse than you. Krishna. He'll say anything, but then he'll do whatever he wants. That's the kind of person Krishna is. He said, no, I assure you. Everybody knows me, that I'm a minister. I always keep my word. I'm giving you my word. Srimati Radharani, please understand. I promise you. I'm telling you for sure. I'll bring Krishna back. This very day I'm leaving, and I'm going to go to Mathura, and Krishna will listen to me because I'm his minister. So it's described that when Radharani, she heard finally, submissively, what Uddhava was saying. And the joy in her body, that message entered her heart, and her whole body just became transformed just by the thought that Krishna may return. And her natural glow and effulgence and what the beauty of her features just stunned, the whole transformation just stunned Uddhava. So he said it again. I can see, it's unbelievable how much love you have for Krishna. I promise you I will bring him back. So that just made her more excited. And then her beauty just increased further, and it went like that. So the members of the royal family, when they saw Uddhava return, and when they saw Vidura return, it was nice to see a relative return, but not just that, it was a sadhu, bringing them to life again. And so this is a very important theme in this chapter, a very important theme in the whole of the Bhagavatam. And so the next two verses, and we're done, it describes how they received him. And they received him, it's stated, Prabhupada explained this, a general rule is a sadhu or saintly person is seen in the place where he was born as an ordinary person. When that saintly person goes elsewhere, he's received differently. Whenever I visit my family members, they don't understand either that I'm a sannyasi and what that means and, you know, any of those things. Once I was attending a family function, and there was an elderly Gujarati man, Mr. Patel, who came to visit. He just wanted to, because I was anyways, upstate New York, and he lives in Syracuse, so he came to my home and visit. Here he came out of his car with his wife, also very elderly, you know, right onto the front lawn, and paid obeisances with my brothers and sisters standing there looking like they'd never seen anything like this before. What's going on? You know, so they see, he's our brother. He's nice. He's doing this religious thing in his life, and that's nice. So let's go watch the football game and talk about, you know, politics and who's getting married to whom and all the, you know, this, the worldly things. What do you think about this and what do you think about that? Just kind of conversation. So when Vidura returned, he was returning to his home, but he was received in a fitting way, as a sadhu is to be received. So a big reception for him, even before they discussed with him, they just made him feel very, very welcome and very comfortable. They fed him sumptuously, they gave him bath, they gave him place to rest, they sat him down to then hear discussions with him. And Vidura, imagine being on pilgrimage for 35 years. When you go and spend some time in rural parts of India, you become accustomed to whatever. Whatever. If there's a place to bathe, that's nice. If there's this, if there's that, it's nice. And if there isn't, you just see whatever there is. And this is, you know, a long time ago. He didn't travel by train or by, even by ambassador. He did by foot. And he lived under a tree and accepted as his alms whatever was there. And so he didn't come back to the palace to have a big meal and, you know, get comfortable again. But they, nonetheless, they wanted to extend that kind of courtesy, that kind of reception. And that, just the last point I wanted to make is, it's very, very, it's another theme. It even starts in the first canto, first chapter of the Bhagavatam, that it opens the heart of the person who has the opportunity to associate with a sadhu, that they open their hearts, they open their homes, they open themselves to the presence of that personality, so that they can receive deep within the heart the message that the sadhu has to deliver. Very, very significant thing. Two things are required for transmission of transcendental knowledge: qualified speaker and qualified audience. Both have to be there. Like Prabhupada gives the example, for conception to take place, there has to be the father that's able to conceive and the mother that's fertile. Both have to be there before conception will take place. Similarly, for transcendental knowledge, there's two sides. Vidura's qualification is being described, and those that are hearing from Vidura, their qualification is being described. So they're very, very eager to hear, but they want to make sure that he feels their eagerness first. So they create the situation for that to happen. And the next section we're going to discuss is the dialogue, with the questions they ask Vidura and how he responds. So, a noisy camera. Okay, so I'm going to end there. I hope I haven't taken too much time. And see if you have like to discuss any of the things you brought up here. Yes.
Go ahead.
It just wonders me if you could say some few words about who this person is, Kripi and Satyaki. Kripi and Satyaki.
I don't know so much about either of them. Kripi. Kripi is the mother of...
Kripacharya's sister.
Kripacharya's sister. So Kripacharya. in the Brahmana amongst the royal family, also like Dronacharya, had some skills, military skills. Kripi was his wife.
He's one of the person who doesn't die like Ashwatthama.
Kripacharya.
And mother of Ashwatthama.
Yeah, because Kripi, exactly. When Draupadi said, "Don't kill Ashwatthama, because I don't want Kripi to have to experience what I have experienced." Kripi is the wife, mother of Ashwatthama. Dronacharya's wife. Dronacharya's wife. Kripi. Yeah. And Satyaki? I don't know. Satyaki. Mantra? Something?
No, I was just curious about, the saintly person of Ajura, when it visits his holy place of pilgrimage, are they fully conscious about, of course, maybe they are fully conscious about all the temple activities that is accumulated there, that is necessary for them to visit these places like this, so the places can be purified and then accumulate again and again.
Your question is, are they conscious of that service that they're doing?
Yes. I mean, they wouldn't take it up.
The consciousness of a saintly person is the consciousness of a humble person. The humble person is, it's the humble saintly person is thinking, I need to be purified. I need to be purified by coming to this place where the Supreme Lord performed some pastime or took his birth or something, did something, and sanctified the place. I need to purify my existence by remembering the Supreme Lord, by coming to this sanctified place. So by the intensity, the consequence of their intense devotion is what alleviates or removes from that place sinful reactions. So their consciousness is the consciousness of humility in service to the Supreme Lord. They then become instruments for other things that the Supreme Lord wants to accomplish. Anything else? Yes.
Was the Buddha justified in neglecting his duties of raising his family and going away into the forest?
Well, I don't know the detail, because I'm not thoroughly conversant in Mahabharata, at what stage his family was able to take care of themselves. Now, certainly we know that his brother, Dhritarashtra, his sons were old enough to run the planet. And he was his brother, so probably something of a contemporary. Most likely his children were quite capable of taking care of themselves and taking care of his wife. Now, I'm not familiar with the detail of what arrangements he made with his sons. You please take care of your mother, because I'm going. One would assume that something was done for that to be properly taken care of. Later on in this chapter, there's a section which we will discuss about renunciation, because that's what's the message that Vidura is bringing to Dhritarashtra. So there's three categories that are mentioned. So since you're bringing this question, I'll just identify them. The three terms that appear are Dhira, Sannyas, and Narottama, or Paramahansa. So Vidura is in that Paramahansa stage. But the other, Dhira, is where one gives up something out of frustration. Vidura was not in that, he wasn't leaving, oh, the heck with it. I don't like being around these people anymore. My brother's son is just this nasty, offensive personality. I'm leaving. That wasn't Vidura's mindset. He was taking this up for a higher cause, to become attached to the Supreme. So those who take up the cause of becoming attached to the Supreme are not, one of the symptoms of such character is one is not negligent in ordinary dealings. So again, I don't know the detail of what Vidura exactly did to make sure that his wife and children were properly situated. Something was there. You know, perhaps by the Lord's arrangement, you know, prior to this, he was aware the time is soon coming that I need to take this step. Let me, over the next few years, arrange things so when that time does come, it's all in place. Whatever. But not irresponsible, this tally-ho, off I go. But that question is specifically raised later on. When Sanjaya gets all upset when Dhritarashtra has gone, said, how can he cheat me in this way? I've taken care of him, I've been faithful, he always consulted me whenever he did anything. How can he just leave? I feel cheated. I've not betrayed him. Why did he betray me? So in the commentary, there's some discussion. Of course, your question is different. This is not, your question is about wife and children, not about a close companion, friend, and servant. Certainly, Sanjaya was able to take care of himself. But was the trust between the two betrayed? And Prabhupada gives this answer that, it's a multiple answer, but in this particular case, Dhritarashtra did what he did because had he consulted the Pandavas, I really want to do this. Is that okay with all of you? Your blind uncle at, you know, over 100 years old going off into the forest alone, is that okay? He would never have permitted that. And Sanjaya, is it okay? You stay here. I'm going. Because I need to do that. I'm sure you understand because you know me. You know me thoroughly. So you please just stay here. I'm going alone to the forest. So, not out of neglect, but out of understanding very clearly higher cause. And confirmed by others like Vidura that yes, this is the right thing to do. Do it. He didn't leave things in a shambles behind himself. Not irresponsible. Anything else? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.